Welcome to PostView.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the Rural Communities Initiative webinar. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Afterwards, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. At that time, if you have a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. If at any time during the conference you need to reach an operator, please press star 0. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Wednesday, February 11, 2009. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Mr. James Butler. Please go ahead, sir.
Yes, thank you. Hello, everyone, and thank you to those who were waiting patiently for us to get started. We were waiting on some other folks to join us. So welcome to part two of our Rural Communities Initiative webinar on rural transportation models serving TANF participants. For anyone who's joining us for the first time, just a little backdrop. During the Rural Communities Academy back in September of 2008, the challenge is providing reliable and cost-effective transportation was identified by many rural communities initiative sites as one of the most critical issues facing rural organizations serving TANF participants. As part of their technical assistance plans, sites expressed interest in learning more about current rural transportation models serving TANF participants, resources on forming partnerships with local transportation stakeholders, and direction on how these types of projects could be funded. Based on the interest expressed by our rural sites, we've designed a series of technical assistance events that focus on the issues of rural transportation. In addition to these series of webinars, we also held a roundtable in West Virginia last month, bringing together rural sites and content specialists to discuss transportation in their areas and to develop action plans for moving forward. On today's webinar, we have three very knowledgeable speakers from different programs who will be discussing their experiences with providing transportation options to TANF participants. They are Sandy Connor from the Transportation Institute Partnership, John Squires from the Community Resources, and Donna Shaughnessy from JAUNT, and that's spelled J-A-U-N-T. After the presentations from our speakers, we will then open the lines up for any of the participants who may have questions or comments. So without further ado, we'll start with our first speaker, Ms. Sandy Connor, from the Transportation Institute Partnership.
Hello, everyone. This is my name is Sandy Connor, and as John just mentioned, I am from Sojourner Douglas College. I wanted to let you know, first of all, the reason why some folks may ask the question, why is it that a college would be engaged in transportation? The reason why you'll find us here at Sojourner Douglas College being actively involved in providing transportation for our population, which is the TANF customers or those persons who are either underemployed or not employed at all. It's because we have here at the college a particular mission, and our mission is for the purpose of creating self-determination. We want to also create and stimulate community-based economic development and to build community capacity as well as individual capacity to become the best persons that they could be. So that's primarily the reason why Sojourner has been engaged in the initiatives of transportation. We got involved back in 1997 at the entry or the onset of welfare reform, and we were engaged at that time with the Baltimore City Department of Social Services as well as the Maryland Transit Administration. And at that time, we were starting our initiative by providing entrepreneurial training for those persons who are unemployed coming from TANF customers, welfare recipients at that particular time. What we formed as a result of that partnership was what we call now, at that time, Advantage 2, and our goal was to train up to 24 participants. Just to give a little bit of background, more background about it, the program was designed after another program that was called Advantage Van, and it was a micro-enterprise project. It was started in Anne Arundel County of Maryland. We received technical assistance from Community Transportation Association of Maryland, better known as CTAA, and we provide the training over a one-year period, providing skills such as basic business, transportation, marketing, and also opportunities for them to have a mentor from the Service Corps of Retired Executives, better known as SCORE. In September of 1988, we graduated our very first class, graduating 18 participants. After graduation, we had many of the participants that launched their businesses, and they began transporting other TANF customers to and from work. Some of the places that they would actually take the participants would be, for example, our office is located in Baltimore City, so they would be accountable for taking people to places like Howard County, Anne Arundel County, and many of them were like appointments such as to nursing facilities and other kind of opportunities that were located in those particular counties. They also did some general transportation for the public, such as maybe school runs. There was no real limitation. They were really their own true business owners, and they were free to operate accordingly. Sojourn at that time, of course, did some of their administrative work for them to keep them moving and keep them going. But as you know, funds do tend to run out, and I might say that this initial program was funded with an estimated, I think, $600,000 initially, and that was to get the vehicles running, situated for the 18 participants, and also some other necessary funding that we needed to operate the program at that time. Because funding did run out, Sojourner began to look for other ways to sustain the participants so that they would not have to go back on welfare. And we at that time launched an LLC, making it Advantage 2 LLC. The college found a way to pay them $8 an hour, guaranteeing them up to 20 hours a week for them to do some miscellaneous runs. And on the next page, you can see a view of the van. This was a van that was given to us through MTA. It was refurbished, and the vans came really from different places. It was refurbished, and the college's name was put on the particular van. What we found, though, after a while, that really many of them could not sustain themselves or keep themselves, we found that less than 10% were really able to keep their programs and businesses going. I was not a part of the Advantage 2 era, but I came on board in like early 2000, and at that particular time began looking at the things or the challenges that were facing the participants that were part of the Advantage 2 program. What we found was that there were many issues and many barriers that caused them not to really be successful and not to sustain themselves. There were legal barriers. Some still had issues with substance abuse. Some still had child care issues. There were multiple barriers, the same kind of barriers that our constituents or our welfare recipients or those who are unemployed tend to face normally, just the regular life skills or life kinds of situations that plague this population were some of the issues that I believe kept them from being successful as a business owner. And as a result, you see that only 10% were able to really sustain themselves. And the other reason, of course, was not having the necessary funding to get the insurance, to maintain the vehicles, and the wherewithal to really, really launch and keep the business going. In 2000, Sojourner received additional funding. We received capital funding in the amount of, I estimated, $600,000. We renovated the building. We purchased additional, this time, brand-new vehicles, hoping that that would not cause the issues that we had before. We purchased 7 brand-new vehicles. We renovated space, lots of space here at the college. We got office equipment, et cetera. And we had operating funds also to work our program, and this was in 2000. We used the lessons that we learned from Advantage 2. Actually, some of the lessons resulted in us even having to seek legal advice because many of the participants didn't remove the college's name from the vehicles, and that was liability issues for not only us, but our partners, which was Maryland Transit Administration and the Department of Human Resources, of course, Baltimore City DSS. So for many reasons, legal reasons and others, we were advised to change the name, but not so much for that reason did we change the name, but because we want our focus to be a little bit more broader. We are an educational institution, so we looked at it in terms of starting something that we could perhaps expand it beyond the funding sources that we currently have, that we would actually begin to launch a training program for others to come in, be it the unemployed or underemployed or others that might just simply join this pool of folks learning more about the transportation industry. So we launched in 2002. into our first class of Transportation Institute Partnership. Just before we launched the Transportation Institute Partnership or TIP program, we also began the Workforce Transportation Referral Center, and that was in 2000. That was a job access and reverse commute program, and we were a brokerage accountable for finding the best transportation solutions that might connect job seekers who are unemployed, either underemployed, to jobs that were in the county or remote areas. And one of the things that we focused on was trying to serve all shifts. Just the information, the Workforce Transportation Referral Center runs, operates services 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and we try to meet all seven shifts. If I'm talking too fast at any time, just somebody stop me, please. Just to give you a little bit about the components of the Transportation Institute Partnership, the initial design, the reason why I said initial design, you'll find later on the slides that we did some changing with the program, but our initial design had five learning modules. One of the modules from 1 through 4, and it took over an 8-week period, consisting of a minimum of 30 hours per week. And this is a little bit shorter, you'll see, from what we did with Advantage 2. Advantage 2 ran a whole year, but we tried to do some things a little bit different with the Transportation Institute Partnership Program. And then, of course, Module 5, which could last for a year or even longer, and that particular module is mentoring, where people have access to us for as long as we're here, as long as we're available, to come ask us anything that they want about their businesses or about job opportunities or et cetera that might help them become self-sufficient. Module 1, you find that we have a program that's called Introduction to Owning a Transportation Business, and it is a 1-week orientation program, workshop more or less, or seminar. And this session really tries to get at their career assessment, their career planning, looking to see whether or not they really do have the finesse, really do have the desire to become a transportation business owner. We also try to look at some of the barriers that they may have so that we can begin to identify them early on if they've got work ethics issues, whatever might keep them from owning and sustaining a business. As we try to do this early on in this first session. Module 2, we began looking at the transportation core competencies. And here is a session that is designed, and I can back up for 1 minute. Our focus of our training is not just to be a business owner, but it's also to get people to think in terms of having other job opportunities in transportation. What we found is that often people have to work first to get some money to start a business, to sustain a business, and even to get additional skill sets in the industry. So the training is designed in such that they can either consider becoming an office clerk, a dispatcher, a reservationist, they can become a driver, and then ultimately begin to look in terms of, do I want to become a business owner? Module 3 is when we began to really focus at the transportation administration pieces of it, looking at how you do your risk management components, how you do your budgets, how you look at running some office kinds of things that's beyond the typical office clerk and dispatcher kinds of job duties and responsibilities. This is where they began to learn some of the skill sets that are required for managing a transportation business. And, of course, Module 4 is the actual module. We began to sit them down and to begin asking them to develop their business plan. And we take them to other places, as you can see in Module 5, to the Small Business Resource Center, which is one of our other partners. Small Business Resource Center, in addition to what we facilitate here in our training facilities here at Sojourner, also provides with other kinds of training, such as accounting. They help us do the business plan. They've got all kinds of resources. And, of course, there are mentors. Some of the mentors from SCORE are still possibly there that they can talk to get additional assistance on how to begin and develop their business. I alluded to the fact that that was the initial phase of how we did it, running the training from 8 weeks and almost sometimes 12 weeks. But then we looked to see that they had some issues that was really impacting their ability to become self-sufficient, their ability to have money just to sustain and maintain themselves. So we began running trials, looking at what was the best way to do this. Would the better way to do it be 6 weeks and then have them come back later after they've looked for job opportunities? And we also tried to get them job opportunities in the transportation industry. If not in the transportation industry, we try to get them jobs in some other place so that they can begin to become self-sufficient. And we currently do have a class right now. We've got one pan of customer that's in that class, one person who has been unemployed, and then there is another person who's also seeking employment. On the next page, you find we have our selection criteria, and I won't go through all of them, but that information is available for anyone who would like to get it. And you see that basically it's the typical kinds of things that you want to have them go through. We have to make sure they meet certain criteria to minimize the risk that is imposed on us here at the college, as well as the Department of Human Resources and Maryland Transit Administration. So we make sure that they go through all these kinds of steps. One of the primary issues or challenges that we have is their ability to, and this has not really been an issue because if, in fact, they come from DSS, they don't have the drug issues or problems, but on occasion, there may be someone who may not be able to pass the drug and alcohol test and or successfully pass the criminal background check. These are things that they do have to go through. One other piece that I did not mention that they also get is they get on-the-job training where they get have an opportunity to come into my shop and do some things, as well as we have vehicles here through the workforce center where they can actually get the on-hand driving experience. So that's one of the reasons why they've got to have passed a criminal background check. And there are also cases when they may have to collect money or funds as well. So that's another reason for things like the criminal background check and the selection criteria that you see on the slide here. You may ask the question, how do we get the folk? I've got to say that some of our challenges, as you'll see going forward, has been getting the folk that can really, really get into the program and just maintain coming to class. And some of the things that we do to try to get them, we participate in job fairs. We pass out the information there, and we're passing out the information twofold. One, to let them know that they can start their businesses, to let them know also about the Workforce Transportation Referral Center, and that typically what we have are job opportunities. So folks who go through our program get first opportunity for getting a job as a part-time driver or whatever position that may come up to work for us in our shop. So we share that information with them at the job fair. We have job developer forums. As a matter of fact, on February the 26th from 1 to 3, we'll be hosting our next kind of regional like job developer forum. And at that particular job developer forum, we share information similar to what we're sharing today, but we look at how we can remove the barriers of transportation and also share job placement ideas and to plan potential successes where we celebrate business owners or employers who've been partners with us. So this is the kinds of things that we do at Job Developer Forum. So FYI for you, the next one that Sojourner will host will be February 26th from 1 to 3. And I can give you that information later for the address. We go to churches, and you can see the other thing, and you see hackers on there. For those who may not know hackers, if you're anywhere in the Baltimore metropolitan area, if you ever see folk on the corners waving their fingers down, trying to flag down, you think a cab or whatever, they are probably illegally trying to get a taxi. And those are the people that we try to get. We actually go to the markets in different places and pass out information, try to screen them and see if they might be potential people that might work with us. We also work with small transportation providers, trying to see if they got folks who are underemployed or not working, and word of mouth, the website, and of course, we have our partners, as you can see here on this page below. Just to give you some highlights, since our inception in 2002, we were purchased, unlike Advantage, we purchased seven brand new vans, and right now these vans are currently being used for training. Where there are some things we're working on to see exactly what will happen to these vans going forward. But right now they're being used for training. Because we are co-located with the Workforce Transportation Referral Center, we share resources. And what that means is some of the rent space, some of the costs for some of the things we do, and even some of the training is done by my dispatcher, someone who's a part of the WHRC. So the person who is my one trainer does not do all the training. She does training, IG training, and then we also have resident experts in the Workforce Transportation Center to also do some training. And they train from the standpoint of the maintenance component, the dispatching component, even office managed component, along with the trainer that's facilitating most of the lessons. We've held 16 classes. Typically what we have is like 2 to 3 classes a year, and we hold a graduation for all of those classes in the month of June. And it's usually a great event because we have the administrator from MTA to come. We have the person from DHR and DSS to come as well. And the people are really excited because it's like a formal graduation. Many times these folks are graduating when they may not have had an opportunity before to do so. So we really do make a big deal about that. As you can see, we enrolled in 94, it's probably a little bit more than 94 participants, but only 57% of them have actually completed the training. I mentioned early on that we hire them. As they go through the program, they have opportunities to work for the Workforce Transportation Referral Center. So we've hired 13 of them over the time, the span that we've had our Workforce Transportation Referral Center here. Two persons have served as our maintenance supervisor, which means there are maintenance management opportunities. Two have been full-time drivers. We have a dispatcher, and 6 part-time drivers have been here. And currently today, we have 5 of them working with us today. One is still in management, and then is my other senior driver. So those are the persons who are currently working with us. 7 are still employed in other transportation businesses. 14 persons, as a result of going through our career assessment, et cetera, realized that transportation was not for them, and they're working in other businesses. 22 have actually registered their businesses with the Public Service Commission, a requirement that we have here in the state of Maryland, but only 6 of them have actually launched their businesses, and 12 of them, which is a good news story, is still in business. And 3 of those are currently working with us. They are subcontractors or sub-grantees for us on our other job access and reverse commute program. 3 have launched other businesses. One lady came through our training, liked what she heard and what she learned, and everything, reading Stephen Covey's book, The 7 Habits of Successful People, decided that transportation was not for her, but she went into a clothing business, and that's what she's doing. 5 of them are minority business enterprise owners, and that's one of our goals as well, and one is actually registered as a DBE. With any good news stories, there's always challenges facing you, and some of our challenges, as I may have alluded early on, has been recruitment, including participants' ability to successfully pass entry exams or to demonstrate their ability to comprehend training. I've got to say that has been kind of minimal because, for the most part, we put them through testing early on where they have to pass math and or reading at a certain level. We can assess early on from our interview process whether or not we think that they'll be able to stay in the course and really comprehend the material. The other thing that we found that has been a major challenge is the fact that they're failing to complete the training. As I mentioned before, 94 of them or more have signed up with us. Costing us still money to run the program, but only 54 of them or 57% of them actually completed all of the requirements. And there are some that are still pending out there, although they may be working in the industry. They've not done things like complete their business plan and their financial projections to show or indicate that they're really serious about getting into this business. And then, of course, the biggest challenge has been resources to sustain a business, including costs for insurance and repairs. Just for your information, these are the next couple of slides to get into what participants have said about our program, and we've been quite pleased with the kind of comments that they have given us. I think I mentioned the first participant, Robin Ireland. she is the one that ends up going into another business. She understands the importance of owning a business. You have Marion Moody, who also said that before she came here, she was a little bit bitter about life just in general, and now she has a better attitude about the work environment and what to do. And, of course, you see the other slides here with the other folks that are here. Karina Tate gave comments. And we, every class, what happens with this is, at our graduation, to give us a source of feedback, we, of course, do a course evaluation form. But a part of our graduation ceremony, we have the participants write what TIP means to them. And this is where this information comes from. It's actually published. And I might also add that the graduation is so formal that they get to invite guests as well. So their family members get to see what they've gone through. Our partners get to see what they've gone through, and they get to share with others just how they feel about the program. And you see Diane Abdullah, John High. John High is one of my MBEs, and so is Davida White. They're MBEs who come into the program. Now, John High, I believe, was not a kind of customer. He was perhaps, I think, unemployed. Had some business in transportation, but was not really functioning, operating up to par and up to level. And he decided to come into our course and is now moving forward. And, of course, just to get a glance of what we look like now compared to the burgundy vehicles back then, we now have the white vans, that are the 15-passenger vans. The signs are magnetic, which means if we loan them or let the participants use them, they can get their own signs and put them on there. And then the other advantage to this is that we don't have to run around chasing them to take our names off the vehicles if, in fact, we transfer the vehicles to them or whatever the case may be. And this concludes my presentation.
Thank you very much, Sandy. Excellent job. We're going to go ahead and move on to our next speaker, who is Mr. John Squires from the Community Resource Group. John is the CEO and founder of the Community Resource Group. He began his work in rural transportation over 30 years ago with a successful proposal to develop a rural public transportation prototype funded by the Federal Highway Administration. He has since worked on several transportation projects, including the design and launch of a car donation program that refurbished, sold, and financed 247 cars to very low-income families for $1,000 each. John currently works on a variety of programs helping low-income populations. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, John.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here, and the first thing I want to make clear is that I'm first and foremost a practitioner. I'm not an expert, and I don't claim any universal truths in what we think we've learned over the last 30 years doing both public and personal transportation here in Arkansas. I think what I want to focus on primarily is the last 5 years that we have worked to provide affordable and reliable used cars for TANF recipients. In 2002, we had completed a demonstration program for TANF participants for the state of Arkansas. And one of the things that we've learned over the years is that when you live by the subsidy, you die by the subsidy. The subsidy's gone, the program goes away. And we've kind of developed a habit of trying to find market-based solutions that provide high-volume solutions for the hard to serve. And I can't think of a group that's harder to serve than, in terms of meeting transportation needs, than the TANF participants. Certainly, we need some large-volume solutions, and the effort that we focused on was trying to do that without government subsidy so that it could expand to meet whatever market there was there. In 2002, the state of Arkansas had a $2,500 down payment assistance program for TANF recipients that had been employed for 60 days. It was a one-time down payment assistance grant. Unfortunately, what seemed to be happening as we looked at that program was that very unsophisticated young, mostly young women, were given $2,500 and sent out to the used car industry to do business. And mostly they failed to successfully negotiate the purchase of a reliable and affordable car. We basically decided that we would set up as a nonprofit used car dealer. We would focus exclusively on trying to provide really affordable and reliable cars for this population group, understanding clearly that if you can't get to work every day, if your car breaks down, then you're not going to stay employed, you're not going to be able to maintain that job, and consequently, you're not going to get out of poverty. Having said that, the slide I think that's up on the screen, I wanted to revisit just very briefly some fundamental things that we believe we've learned. And like I said, I'm not suggesting any universal truth here. This is where we came out. Well, the slide says you can't make it in rural America without a car. The reality is that you mostly can't make it anywhere in America without a car. And even those people that will tell you that you can do it in urban areas without a car all have a car at home, or they don't ride public transit very often. If TANF participants are using employment as their primary strategy for getting out of poverty, they simply need a car. You forget about buying buses and chauffeuring participants to work. It's simply too expensive. The other part of it is that it never seems to get beyond the pilot project stage, and it goes away when the subsidy runs out. We worked in public transit long enough to be able to do the math. You count the number of passenger trips provided in a given time period, you divide that into the total cost of providing the rides, you'll see very quickly why subsidized personal cars make better economic sense. And it also increases the chance that the person is actually going to be able to use employment as a strategy for getting out of poverty. To expect a single mom with mostly limited education and even more limited job prospects to make it without a car, in our estimation, is to set them up for failure. You can't get to work, shopping, drop the kids at school, do the laundry, pick up the kids after school activities. Truth is, it's hard enough to do that when you have a car, and impossible if you have to spend time waiting for the bus. Now, one of the things that we learned very quickly is everyone wants a car, but not everyone wants a job. Maybe we're getting a little cynical after having done this a while, but clearly, the challenge is to figure out which clients are really motivated to use the transportation to keep the job. I've just lost my notes. Here we are. One of the things that we found out very quickly is that we never met a TANF participant that didn't want a car, preferably a red car. There were a lot of reasons for wanting a car. Not all of them, however, involved a job. I think we all know that transportation, or that a car, is more than just work transportation. It represents status, it represents freedom, and at the risk of being politically incorrect, sometimes it even represents a ride for your boyfriend. I think the challenge is to try to figure out which participants understand that unless car payments are made, the car goes away. That unless the car is maintained, the car will break down and you'll lose your job. That you still have to make the payments even when it's not running, or you lose the car. The challenge is how to invest in those that are most likely to succeed. And some of the keys to doing this we found is people need to understand that they must be employed in order to afford the vehicle. They must be motivated and supported in their effort to keep the job that allows them to make the car payments and keep the car running. They need to know what it takes to what car ownership requires. For many, I think we have to remember that this is really their first car. And a lot of us assume, because we've had cars in our family all our lives, that everybody knows how to take care of a car. It's simply not so in our experience. The other part of this slide says there won't ever be enough money to invest in cars for everyone. So the challenge is to select those most likely to succeed, give them the knowledge, the training they need to understand what's really involved in car ownership, and provide them with the support they need to succeed. To do that, I think it's important to understand that an affordable and reliable car is not an oxymoron or a catch-22 necessarily. But too often, a reliable car costs too much to be affordable for this particular client group, and equally often, the affordable car simply isn't reliable. So if you're designing a program, you've got to balance both the affordability and the reliability, and to do that, you simply must define your terms. These are some good used car standards that we developed painfully over a long, over the 5 years that we worked in this program. If you're really looking to help somebody get the best balance between affordability and reliability, you want to create some standards that, we're not going to pay for a car that's 10 years old because it's going to break down on you very quickly. The odometer reading needs to be under 75,000 miles. Needs to be a sedan or a minivan, no trick trucks or muscle cars, two-wheel drive. You don't need an off-the-road vehicle. 4 to 6 cylinder for gas mileage, no branded title. You want to make sure that you're not being, or whoever's selling the car isn't selling something that was in Hurricane Katrina or underwater. And the final part is that whenever you buy a car, if it's a lemon, it's going to break down and you're going to have problems with it within the first 30 days. And a 30-day unlimited mileage bumper-to-bumper warranty is different than a powertrain warranty. There's lots of other things that have to go wrong before the powertrain is affected. The other piece, before I move on to this slide, I just wanted to make one more comment here. The same thing applies to affordability. Money Magazine recommends not paying more than 8 to 10% of your gross income for a car. For low wage earners, go with a lower percentage because there's less financial cushion available. You simply need to multiply the participant's hourly wage times the number of hours per month times 8%, and that'll give you a pretty good idea of what they can afford for a car payment. And it's important to remember that a car payment is only the tip of the iceberg in the cost of owning a car. You've got gas and insurance and repairs and maintenance and all the other things, tires, and they always hit when you have the least amount of money to pay for them. One of the things that we came to believe very strongly was, just like in the affordable home business, they've learned that if you go through home buyer education, your chances of succeeding as a homeowner are greater, substantially greater, than if you simply go and buy a home on your own. And so we're strong proponents of consumer education. And we also came to realize that if somebody really wanted a car, not just because they could get it for free or little or nothing, but were really serious about using it to use employment as a strategy for getting out of poverty, they would go through the process of spending 90 minutes in class for 6 to 8 weeks. And some of these are listed here are some of the topics that we tried to cover to make them as responsible and knowledgeable car owners as they could be. What people don't know about owning a car comes to light very quickly when you're working in financing and providing cars for this particular group of participants. One of the things that we, in our particular used car program, we ran a virtual car lot on the web. Case managers could link up to the website and show their clients a number of cars, choices. There was all the information we had about the car was there for their inspection. They could see the car and select the one that they wanted to purchase. We also provided zero interest financing for up to 30 months in order to keep these cars affordable, and partly because we're mission driven, not profit driven. We wanted as much of their hard-earned money going toward reducing the debt on that car as quickly as possible, and so that they could get as much car for the money as possible. Nonetheless, we still had to develop a collections process so that we minimized our losses on the loans that we had made. And we took what we called a buyer advocate approach to collections, where before their first payment was due, we had someone in our finance department calling them, making contact, and introducing themselves as their buyer advocate. And they really were a buyer advocate, because we measured our collection success not by how many loans we got back or how many cars we repossessed, but by how many people actually succeeded with the help of their buyer advocate to successfully pay off the car, which was good for us and good for them. One of the things, some things we learned that this particular client group really needs high touch, needs somebody to listen to, someone to commiserate. Mostly they have a very slim support system out there. But then at the end of the day, we would, if the person simply wasn't able to afford the car, wasn't interested in, was no longer working, we would, of course, repossess it, refurbish it, and reallocate it to another client that was trying to use the car to go to work. And just some final thoughts here. One of the things that we kept seeing was that it seemed to us that the state was unwilling to make the level of investment in these individuals' transportation needs that would really give them a chance to succeed. There was enough money to get them into a car that they could just barely afford, and if something went wrong, child got sick, they lost their job, something happened, they got kicked out of their apartment, they were too close to the economic edge, and oftentimes it was the car payment that languished. Vehicle affordability is clearly more than the car payment. That's just, like I said, the tip of the iceberg. It's those other things that you don't budget for that really oftentimes sink a CANF participant in their quest to own and keep a car operating. If you're looking for a large-scale solution, a statewide program, it's all about sales volume, it's having enough capital to finance the cars, it's setting high vehicle standards and selecting carefully who you're going to lend to. And we think that getting a car, if you want it bad enough to go to class and do your homework and learn what you need to know about operating that car, chances are you're going to be a pretty good risk, certainly better than somebody who gets a job for 60 days and gets the car and immediately quits their job. And believe me, we had plenty of that. Keeping the car, we think, has to be tied to maintaining employment. This can be worked out in the sales agreement. But if the focus is just on getting the car, it's the client gets the car, but they don't necessarily maintain their strategy for getting out of poverty through employment. And the last thing that we saw throughout our whole financing and providing cars is that the stronger the family support system, the community support system, the greater chances people had of succeeding. Hopefully some of those will be of value, some of these things that we learned over the years will be of value to you, and look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Our next speaker is Ms. Donna Shaughnessy from Jaunt. Donna is the Executive Director of Jaunt Incorporated, a regional public transportation system in Central Virginia. The 65-vehicle fleet of small buses and vans covers about 2,500 square miles, including the city of Charlottesville and the counties of Albemarle, Buckingham, Louisiana, Louisa, and Nelson. She holds a master's degree in planning from the University of Virginia. She is a certified community transit manager and has been working in the transportation field since 1982. Ladies and gentlemen, Donna Shaughnessy.
Well, thanks, everyone. It's fun to follow up after people were not exploring the public transportation option, and so that's what we do. I'll give you a little bit of background about Jaunt, just to give you the framework, and then I'll talk a little bit about our welfare to work project that we think was very successful, and we'd love to have kept doing it. But James mentioned several of these items, but we're owned by the local governments that we serve, and we use federal, state, and local dollars to supplement the fares that we take in. And we've gotten lots of recognition from the federal and state governments and elsewhere. So we've been around since 1976, and we keep on growing every year, so we're pretty excited. We do three main things. One is urban service for people with disabilities. We fill in where the city bus system can't. Then we do a lot of coordinated human service agency transportation. And out in the rural areas, we're the bus system, so we have commuter routes, and we have a lot of demand response service. And what we do in each locality depends on what they're willing to pay for or help pay for. We have commuter routes, which are we're a big piece of the puzzle in trying to help people get make the transition from welfare to work. Right now, in most cases, they're available Monday through Friday. We have a few 7-day-a-week commuter routes as well. They start pretty darn early in the morning, and because they're going such a long distance, some don't end up until 6:30 at night. So the cost for each of those is about $2 to $3.50 each way, depending on the route. This is just a quick map to show you what some of the distances involved are. The areas in the green are areas in which we have demand response service. The gray areas are counties we just happen to do some commuter routes, and that's about it. We hope to bring them into the fold and be doing more out that in that direction in the future. So we have demand response service in several of our counties, 7 days a week in the core area of Charlottesville and Albemarle, and 6 days a week out just outside the city in Louisa County, and then several days a week in some of the other outlying counties. So we've also Jaunt got started as a coordinated human service agency provider. So in the gas crisis in the 70s, nobody wanted to pay for each agency to put its own van out there and bring people in. So they pooled their services, and Jaunt got started with just one human service agency van, and we covered a huge area. But we've expanded since then. We try to do everything we can so that agencies can avoid having to take on the responsibility of buying a vehicle and paying a driver and that kind of thing. So we've been pretty successful in that regard. Our ridership overall it's over a quarter million trips a year. About a third of them are for medical appointments and about a third for work, and then another third are for social appointments or going to the grocery store or going to the senior center or whatever. About a third of the passengers are seniors, and three-quarters of them have a disability of some kind. We're happy to have both of those groups as our core riders. Out in the rural areas, about a quarter of the people we carry are going to work, and 30% are definitely in the low-income category, although we don't certainly do income checks. Anybody can ride. Our funding, as you can see, comes from a lot of sources, and the more people we have supporting us, the happier we are, because that will, in tough times, that means that somebody's going to keep giving us money, we hope. Last year we took in about $5 million from various places to keep ourselves going, and that's just for operations. That doesn't cover capital, which is something else again. I told you about the gas crisis and the Human Service Agency clients. Local governments basically were a big piece of that because they got tired of having every agency ask them for money to buy a vehicle, and it didn't make any sense. Also, once the agencies got going on service, the people who weren't clients of an agency also wanted to get on board, and so we added that feature. And in the beginning, we started out with mostly human service and just a little bit of public, and over the years, the last 30 years, it's reversed completely, so it's mostly public and just a little bit of human service agency transportation. The reason it was successful, we believe, is that our local planning district was very, very supportive, and when agencies would come in and say, we want to buy a van, as they had to do back in the olden days with the A33 approval process, they'd say, no, you need to use Jaunt, and they would talk to us about how we could be more useful to them. So the local governments have really stepped up to the plate and been really helpful, and we think we're giving people a really big bang for their buck, and so many of our localities are, well, most, they're all quite happy with the service because we really do a good job. But coordination isn't easy. People often get in the way of that, so lots of agencies want to have their own bus so they can decide when their clients get picked up and where they go and how long it takes, and sometimes that's been an obstacle. There's lots of regulations that get in the way, of course. We have federal drug testing and Head Start regulations and all these other things I'm sure all of you have seen, and sometimes that's really not easy to get around. Of course, transportation is expensive, especially when you have all the extra features that we have in terms, like we have computers in every vehicle, and we have very high quality for high standards for safety and those kinds of things, so that doesn't come cheap. And sometimes agencies don't really realize how much it costs them to provide transportation, so they think they can do it for, you know, just the amount of money it takes for gas, which we all know not true. So the Welfare to Work project that we did was started back in 1997. Virginia was one of the first states to try welfare reform. They tried a pretty different approach, and so we got a jump start in the whole process. We had a state grant to begin with, and then Virginia had not spent all their TANF dollars, so we were able to use federal job access funding along with state TANF dollars to provide the service for free. So it was 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We would go anywhere for anyone as long as they had been vetted by their case managers at social services. So they were the gatekeepers. They said, here's a client that can use your service. And so we would not only take people to work, we would take them to drop their kids off at daycare on the way. We'd take them to job training. We also, at one point, were actually taking people to driver's license classes so they could learn to drive because some of them didn't have licenses. And we also cooperated with our local other bus systems so that they got some funding through this to provide other services as well. Over the course of the grant, we provided over 100,000 trips and helped 460 clients, and that doesn't include the clients that were covered by extra services on the fixed route system in the city. It was free, and we had some great success stories. This young woman you see in the photo on the left is one of our star clients. She had never worked before and got to work at Krispy Kreme and was really... She was so happy to be working and just
She was a delight to have with us, and she went on to be quite successful, so we're pretty pleased with her. Now, some of the things that we had to deal with were, we had some tough clients. We're used to carrying people ordinarily who loved us. It was clear to lots of people that we were what stood between them and not having to move to a nursing home or not being able to work. And we really, it was more of a challenge dealing with some folks on welfare who, some of them really weren't happy about having to go to work, and that showed, and they argued with the drivers, and they do some interesting things. So it took some adjustments for us to try to make sure that happened. We were traveling some incredibly long distances. If the only job someone could get was an hour and a half away at McDonald's, but we would go there, even in the middle of the night, to make sure they got there. And that what didn't necessarily look like a great use of money, but for someone who'd never had a job, this way they had a resume, they got work experience, and we weren't going to continue to do that forever, but it was a great way to get people into the door and get them job experience. We also never had to deal with car seats to any large extent before, but we were carrying women with as many as 5 children who needed to go to daycare, so managing that kind of level of car seats was a challenge. Well, Grant paid for those, but just hooking 5 children into car seats definitely takes a long time if you're going to do it correctly. So justifying the expense was... the local governments would say, well, I don't believe that you just sent a vehicle all the way, 60 miles to take this person to work who's only making $5 an hour. But I think that we called it, it's like college. You don't expect to get an immediate return when you send your kid to college. You expect that to be paid back over a lifetime. And that's the same kind of thing that we saw with the folks who were riding with us. One of the both good and bad things that in our experience was, because we didn't really want to run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, during the middle of the night, we were using cabs to fill in some of those gaps. And they were great because they would go anywhere at any time, and that made it a lot simpler for us. On the other hand, when you're using cabs, that's a whole different ballgame from the kinds of folks that we were used to dealing with. And so sometimes they could be pretty challenging. And then we got into a cab war where they were using us to fight with each other. So that was not a good situation, but all in all, we were really grateful to have them helping out, and we thought that was really useful. So the grant eventually ended because the state TANF dollars had been used up, so they no longer had to unload those under pressure from the feds. And it was really got hard to find that 50% local match. We had a couple of project ideas, but it didn't really work out very well. But what we saw was that lots of the clients we had been carrying were able to transition either to our regular service, or they were able to get cars. Some of them got donated cars as we worked with a local community action agency. So we thought that that part worked really well. I know that the challenge of pulling off something like John, I mean, we were lucky we got started back when the time was right, back in the 70s, but it can still happen. We've had at least 10 new transportation systems start up in Virginia, and really it just takes one really dedicated person to make it happen. I mean, in our case, just one agency donated a van after people have been talking about it for 5 years, and one agency donated a driver. And then they all just came together, and so we've grown into something as big as we are at this point, and which we're really happy about. This slide is a little dated, I realize, because actually we've done 6 million trips over the years, and so we're growing as we speak. We expect to break a new record again this year for more transportation. And so that's our staff, at least part of them. We couldn't get everybody there because somebody had to be out driving, and... thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much, Donna. Mm-hmm. Okay, unless any of the speakers have any additional comments, we can go ahead and open up the line for comments or questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to register a question, please press 1 followed by 4 on your telephone. You'll hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. If your question has been answered and you'd like to withdraw, please press 1 followed by 3. If you're using a speakerphone, please lift your handset before entering your request. One moment, please, for the first question.
also remind participants that they can register a question online by typing it into the Q&A box at the top of your screen.
Questions from the phones at this time.
We have one question from online. The question is, what is an LLC?
The question is, that's a legal term. It's a form of corporation, and it's a limited liability corporation. It minimizes your liabilities coming back to you. Someone can sue, but they would sue the corporation. It's a private type of corporation, a lower version of a corporation. Did that answer the person's question?
I hope so. Operator, are there any questions on the phone?
Still no questions.
It's really difficult to hear you, so I don't know if everyone heard the instructions on how to register a question over the phone.
Okay, let me repeat them. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to register a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, to register a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4.
We have another comment on the online questions, and someone has asked for the contact email for the presenters. We will send that to everyone who has called in today, along with the PowerPoint presentation, so we'll make sure that their email and contact information is on there as well. We have another question for John Squires. This question asks, what funding sources are used to help purchase the used cars for participants?
Actually, those were internal funds of Community Resource Group. We're actually a CDFI, which is a certified development lending institution. We make a number of different types of loans to families and communities around the in a 7-state region. We actually invested our own assets and lost our own assets in trying to find a large-scale solution to the affordability and reliability problems that TANF participants were facing in Arkansas. So all of the financing resources, several million dollars, came from our corporate resources. There was no government money involved in this other than the same down payment that the used car dealers were eligible for from the state.
This is Louisa talking from the Rural Communities Initiative. Can you talk a little bit more? You said that there were sometimes about 4 to 5 kids who would have to be loaded in the van with their car seats. Can you talk a little bit more about how that you actually structured dropping them off either at childcare, Head Start school, and getting their mother or father to work?
Sure. When they made the reservation, we would just schedule, they would have to make the reservation for every trip. So we'd say, Mom says, I need to be picked up at 7:15, and then I'm going to have to drop this kid off here and this kid off there, etc. So we would make multiple reservations for them, which is a little tricky. Our computer system wasn't as crazy about that as it might have been, but we did find a way to make that work.
Can I ask another question on that same point? Okay. Did you provide the car seats? I think I heard you say that. And were you accountable for strapping them in? And how did that really work?
Yeah, we did buy the grant paid for the car seats, and we had to keep them current. As you know, they go out of legality here pretty quickly. So We trained all our staff on how to install car seats. We left a lot of them strapped in, and we tried to not have to reinstall them in every vehicle. And some of our vehicles come with built-in child seats, which is great. But it was a challenge because I don't know how many of you have taken that class, but it's a hard job. It's not easy for sure to strap a car seat incorrectly, and our drivers were responsible for that.
Thank you.
This is John Squires. I wanted to make an observation. First, we operated a public transit system for over 20 years, so I want to put this in the context that we are strong supporters of public transit. However, I am not a supporter of public transit as a primary source of transportation for people going to work. And it's all about economics. The JAUNT program, and I'm picking on you because you're the only one who provided the numbers to be picked on. You do about 250,000 passenger trips, per year at a cost of $4.7 million plus additional capital costs. If you take that $4.7 million and you divide it by 250,000, you get a per passenger one-way trip of about $1,880. I don't know what your actual number actually turns out to be, but if you look at $1,880 for a one-way trip times 10 trips to and from work 5 days a week, and you do that for 4.5 weeks, and then you do that for 12 months, it has basically cost over $9,000 to provide that transportation for that individual going to work. None of the cars that we sold cost $9,000, and most of the cost was externalized from the taxpayer to the individual that got the car. And so the down payment assistance or any assistance given by the state to help subsidize helping someone get a car is certainly cost effective when compared to public transportation. And I want to be clear that I think public transportation is absolutely essential for people with disabilities, for people that for one reason or another can't drive, either too young or for some other reason, and for elderly folks. But for folks trying to go to work, waiting for the bus isn't going to get you out of poverty.
John, can I comment, Don, if you don't mind?
Sure.
I hear what you're saying, and that's a great comment, and that's something that I struggle with because I also run a job access reverse commute program similar to what Donna talked about. But one of the challenges that I'm having, because I'm now in the process of what I do, is I transition them off of my services, and one of the things I do to try to do that is ride share, carpool, et cetera, and also trying to get them to get their own cars. We have a relationship with Marty Swartz, our vehicle to change, who's here, what we've worked with in the past to try to get folks to get a car. But our challenges have been that this population, like all other barriers, cannot drive. Can't seem to be able to get that, and we're looking at some opportunities here to try to get them the training for it, or the because that within itself is a problem to be able to go to driver's ed and get the training for it, but that's been one of our problems. They can't drive for one reason or the other, or some of my folks have been elderly. They're not all younger folk who are in the workforce, so to speak, so that's been some of my challenge, but I do agree with what you're saying.
And I agree, too. I just want to make a quick comment on the ability to drive. One of the things we found even in rural areas were that people may have gone to driver's ed in high school or maybe not, but they probably hadn't owned a car or hadn't owned it for very long. And one of the things we worked with was trying to set up driver training programs. Again, it requires subsidy, but it's still cheaper than the alternative. The other thing that we learned very quickly is on a used car, you want to require comprehensive insurance for at least the first 6 months. Admittedly, it's cost prohibitive if you're having to pay it along with your car payment, but typically we would find that if we had a bad driver, that accident would happen in the first 6 months, and hopefully no one was hurt, but the asset was replaced by the insurance company, and so we were able to get the person back into a car.
Operator, are there any other questions on the phone line?
No, there are not.
Okay, and there are no more questions online. James, do you want to say a final word?
Sure, sure. Just wanted to thank everyone. Thanks again to all of the participants for attending this webinar. Thanks to all of our speakers, Sandy, John, and Donna, for sharing their wealth of knowledge and experience working with rural transportation initiatives that serve TANF participants. And a special thanks to the staff at ICF International, who was very instrumental in putting together this webinar. As Allison mentioned earlier, there will be the PowerPoint presentation and an audio recording from today's webinar will be made available for everyone within the coming weeks. Also, you can feel free to email anyone on the Rural Communities Initiative team if you have any further questions. So, on behalf of the Office of Family Assistance, thank you all very much and have a pleasant day.
Ladies and gentlemen, does this conclude the call for today?